Welcome to the Stabbin' Stylists Podcast. I'm Randa.
And I'm Ashley.
We are just two stylists who love true crime and hair, and we're going to tell you about both.
This is a true crime podcast. These stories may be disturbing to some. Listener discretion is advised.
Background. Like 3 years ago, I was riding in the car with my mom and my husband, and he mentioned the fact that his brother was an unsolved case in Chattanooga, and I had no clue about this. So I stored it away in my head. I started Googling some stuff on it and went to work and was like, hey, Randa, this is weird. Look at this.
Hey, girly, you like true crime? Check this out.
So then one day at work, if you remember this, I literally texted my dad and I was like, hey, do you think the cold case unit will talk to me? And I went to the back porch of the old salon and called the cold case unit, and they were amazing. They have since been disbanded, which is a crying shame. But I met with them and got some really good information, and we started working on getting this talked about again, getting investigated again. And they were telling us that they were going to be disbanded. So they were telling us, like, you know, listen, this is all we can do. But
yeah, they knew it was coming. And they tried to prepare the families that they had contact with as best they could, but they only had, you know, so much time and resources left.
And so much funding in general. But Officer Mike Mathis was an absolute gem. He was amazing. He met with me and Yuri. He talked with us about everything, and that's where Mary Kate, we could talk about Mary Kate on this.
Ooh, 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 ooh.
I was telling Mary Kate, you know, this whole crazy story, and she said, I went to high school with a girl that has a podcast that's from here in Cleveland, but she lives in Knoxville now, and so we got hooked up with Taylor and Morgan from Creeps and Crimes. They covered Marty in an episode. It's absolutely amazing if you want to go back and listen to that one, but then we ended up meeting with the Hamilton County Police Department cold case detective. And by that point, we had interviewed people the police hadn't talked to. We had hours and hours of research.
And our own investigation.
Right.
Really.
Randa and I went down there. We drove around to get a feel of the area to see where these places that we were hearing so much about was, get our own ideas on things.
And I think once we run this down to you, you'll understand why we needed to go drive the route. Like, we went to the neighborhood. We saw where, you know, all of these pivotal points in the case were. We made the drive out to the lake. We timed it just to see how far it was. I mean, we put a lot of time into this.
And we have not done an episode on this case because Hamilton County was working on it, but now Hamilton County does not have the resources to give to these cold cases, and so now no one's working on it. Oh, and like a year and a half ago, I was on the news.
Yes.
I was on the news about the disbanding of cold case and getting cold cases back out there. So this is something that we've been working on the last few years. But we wanted to let the investigators do their thing, and we didn't want to interfere with that. But now that we know this case is not being worked, we want to present it to you guys.
I want to be clear. It's not technically closed.
Right.
It's just not being worked on by anyone.
Right. It's not actively being investigated. So in saying that, actually, this is an open case. We don't have much on this case.
Yes. And we know this because we were in contact with the detective that was working on the case. And we have since been in contact with him saying, I'm not on it. No one's on it. Right. So
here we are. I feel like we are probably the best two people to talk about this case because we have talked to friends, family, people who did not even think they were relevant in the grand scheme of things. But then talking to them, we got so many little pieces and nuggets of information that they didn't even know they were giving us. So it has been a journey. And oh, and the newspaper article too. We're going off on that one. But while I was going through all the newspaper articles last summer in my house, I even found a newspaper article related to his death in my attic. So I feel like this is what we're supposed to be doing.
Me too. And the other thing is, like, Marty is the whole reason that this entire projection has started.
It really
is. He is the reason that we were like, hey, I think we could do this. And in like a not so weird way, he's the reason.
He is. And I think even if this never gets solved, because at this point, chances are probably slim.
Very thin, yeah.
I want to talk about it for him. And not just that, I want to, in a way, dedicate this to Mary Kate also, because she helped us so much. Mary Kate was in the trenches with us.
She really was. She really was.
She was on top of it. And so she would really appreciate this. And next month is the 27th anniversary. So when this episode comes out, the anniversary, this will come out on the 15th. The anniversary is on the 17th.
Yeah, it's weird to think that, like, that's 27 years that somebody's got away with this and Marty hasn't been here.
Right.
You know, because like when you get so close to a case like this, you feel like you know the person that you're looking into.
Oh,
like
absolutely.
We were just talking about this before we hit record. It was like, I feel like I know Marty, and that's probably like a pompous ass thing to say, but like, I feel like I know this. Like, I've asked some personal-ass questions about this man. I feel like I know him.
I mean, we dug into the details of his life.
And dug.
Yeah. And he sounded, I don't know that we can even convey how awesome he sounded.
He, what a force, first of all.
Yes.
Like, I feel like he just gives off such sweet and loving energy. That's everything.
Marty was smart.
Yeah.
People say Marty was
educated.
Genius. Yes. And could dress. Mm-hmm. So many people say that they knew him when he was Ralph Lauren.
I love. Okay. So my favorite picture of Marty is the one when he's in the little suit with the.
Yes.
It looks like a little, like a bowler hat. Almost.
Yeah. Like a little straw brim hat. I love it. And where I've been calling out to people like, hey, email me. I have gotten emails.
We have.
Yes.
Okay.
And she said that I could share the story. So I'm going to share the story.
Okay, please.
Her grandmother was super Baptist, like super Baptist. And they had finally convinced her, like, hey, girl, come with us to the Episcopalian church.
Yeah. Try this out.
Yeah. So Marty gets up there and he starts talking about how he knew he loved the Episcopalian church when he smelled it because it smelled like bourbon and old money. And she said she wanted to crawl under the pew. She was so embarrassed because her Baptist grandma was there. But now every single Christmas Eve, they say a little toast to Marty smelling like bourbon and old money. And that
bourbon and old money.
But now, like, you know Marty. So that is the epitome. Like, that says Marty. He said that in a sermon. That's Marty Davis for you.
Yeah.
So let's tell people about him. We don't have much on this case. Obviously, 27 years later, 25 years later, when we started investigating this, it was hard to break through the wall of getting people to trust us. And after they did, they have been absolutely amazing.
Yes.
And I hope we are lifelong friends now.
Also, this case taught us a lot about how to approach people when we're talking about these cold cases, when there are family members to approach.
Right.
Sometimes you're not going to be able to get in touch with people, but this taught us a lot about how to say, hey,
right,
this is what I'm doing, this is, you know, the information that I need, do you have it?
Right. Marty Davis was
born Charles Martin Davis.
And he was born February 19th, 1962, to Ivadine and Tom at the Naval Air Station in Key West, Florida. He was the fourth child. Mitzi, Tommy, Valerie, and Marty were those children between Ivadine and Tommy. And at some point, they ended up moving back here. Tommy and Ivadine get a divorce. By 1975, Tommy and Debbie were married. Debbie's my mother-in-law. That's Yuri's mother. Marty actually lived with them for like a little bit of time. And I'm not going to go too much into Ivadine's background because Ivadine is not here to defend herself and it doesn't really matter. But Marty was bounced around and moved around a lot as a kid.
Yeah.
And I only say that because I feel like so much in his later life, he struggled with desperately wanting stability.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, I don't know Marty.
You weren't there for that.
Right. But I think his childhood kind of played such a role into making Marty who he was. So I feel like I at least need to, say that he did bounce around a lot. Even though he had this chaotic childhood, he graduated Cleveland High School in 1980 and went to UTC.
University of Tennessee at Chattanooga.
So there he is a political science major. And at that time, he's working at the Chattanooga Library, which I'm pretty sure he worked there in high school also.
Yep.
But he was definitely working there when he went to UTC. And while he was working there, that's how he met Mimi and Jolie. He met Mimi working at the library. When he meets them, he starts going to the Episcopal Church with them. And as soon as he starts going, he's like, I absolutely love this.
He's like, this is it.
Yes, like, this is it for me. Love it. He loved the look of it, the sights of it, the smell of it. Like, I've heard multiple people mention that Marty just loved the smell of the Episcopal Church. And their churches are so pretty. So Mimi and Jolie went to St. Luke's. And they were already heavy involved in, like, the youth group and the youth organizations at St. Luke's. And Jolie worked at Camp Billy Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And so Camp Billy Johnson is a camp for underprivileged children that one of the people that I talked to said that they would like make a suitcase for them of like new clothes and stuff like that.
And they get that summer camp experience
exactly
where their parents can maybe afford to send them otherwise.
Exactly. And you have to think that's going to melt Marty's heart because he was an underprivileged child.
Exactly. Yeah.
He, you know, didn't have the best growing up situation. So that really stuck to him to like, he loved that. Like, that's what he needed to do with his life.
I feel like at this point in his life, he's like, I've found a place where I belong, where I can help.
Exactly. Exactly. That's exactly where I feel like he was in his element.
He's a helper. Yeah. Yes. Like, he loves to help. It feels something in him to help others, you know? And I think that he finally found a place where he was like, I can do that.
And Mimi even said the Marty she met at the library and the Marty she saw at church were like two different people.
Mm-hmm.
Like the person she saw at the library was quiet.
Closed off.
Yes. And then he gets to the church and he's happy. He's talkative. He's friendly.
He felt safe, I'm sure.
Yes. I love that. He's going to St. Luke's with them and he's wanting to get sponsored to go to like seminary by this point. And they tell him, you either need to go back and you need to get a little bit more schooling or you need to go to the military and get some time under your belt. So he goes up to University of Virginia to study international economics. And he was working at the American Heart Association. He comes back, everything had went fine. And he decides, you know, let's do this. So he enrolled at SWANE, which is SWANE, the University of the South. But around here, we call it SWANE. And it's a private Episcopal liberal arts college that is actually the, like, official seminary of the Episcopal Church. And Michael said that it is absolutely beautiful. Like, he said it is gorgeous campus there. And actually, when he's at SWANE is when he meets Michael. And those two are the cutest best friends. And to see him talk about Marty in this time in their life makes him literally light up. Michael has been the biggest contributor to this case. He is amazing. You know, he even told a couple people at the beginning, like, what if these kids are the ones that solve it? And then, like, you know, we are trying. We want people to talk about this. We are
desperately trying.
Marty was awesome. And I just want people to know that. Even if this never gets solved, I want people to know.
Marty was here and he contributed and it was incredible.
So on his path to priesthood, he worked as a deacon at St. Peter's Episcopal Church in Chattanooga. And you actually have to do that for like 6 months to a year before you're like out on your own doing things. So in 1991, he was ordained at 29 years old, and he was the youngest person at that time in Tennessee to be ordained as a priest. So he moves back to Chattanooga, and that makes him the first gay priest in the Chattanooga area.
Yep.
So that is amazing, especially in the early to mid-90s, you know? Like, that was a different world then. So he was making waves, and that's awesome.
Huge waves.
So Michael actually remembers that Marty would go to St. Peter's and St. Mary's Grammar School, and he said he could just, like, make up the coolest story for these kids just off the cuff. Just tell them these stories. He actually had an unpublished children's novel that he had written. So Marty loved the kids. Like, that's always something that through his whole life is he loved working with the youth.
I think he never wanted a kid to feel left out like he felt left
exactly.
out.
He wanted everyone to be included and know they're loved. And he also really loved doing community service in, like, the poorest areas in Chattanooga. He'd hand out blankets and food. He'd pick up people off the side of the road and give them rides. He would literally pull money out of his pocket and just hand them to people. Like, he was his happiest helping.
Yeah. A true humanitarian. Like, yeah. Ready to help.
At all times. So he was assigned to be the rector of St. Mary's the Virgin in Chattanooga, and he had actually requested this because it was a pretty much all Black congregation and it was in mission status. So what that means is they were not bringing in enough money to support themselves. The diocese was having to support them.
Yeah.
And the building was run down. It was just like a concrete block building. There was nothing nice about it. It wasn't like the beautiful churches that, like, Marty was used to. And
we went and found it. It's nothing.
Yeah. So as soon as Marty gets this church, he jumps right in. He landscapes, he paints the building, he makes his own altar hanging, and he, like, transforms this whole church. Just
gussies are up good.
Yes. Yes.
As he makes best it, he can.
He makes it his home because that's it. So by 1993, he was so excited because the other thing he always wanted was his own home. Him and Michael had actually had an apartment together for years, but Marty bought the house at 3917 Sunbeam Avenue, which is literally directly behind Grace Church. Like, you can see Grace Episcopal from Marty's house.
Yep.
As a little bit of context for anyone wondering what area we're going to be in. And I'm jealous of this back porch. Because this porch has been brought up multiple times. They would hang out there. And by this time, he was on the medical ethics committee of Memorial Hospital. He was a member of Chattanooga Cares, which is they help people diagnosed with HIV or AIDS. And he was the founder and conveyor of the Chattanooga Chapter of Integrity. I could not find what that is. I don't know if they've changed names and it's just been so long, but I can't completely... I tried to, like, search multiple different ways. So I'm guessing the name's just been changed over the years or something.
Or it's no longer a foundation or something.
Right. So it was on that back porch in 1995 that Marty and their friend Chris started talking about their churches. Chris and Marty had met years before at a conference center before he ever even went to seminary. And she was a woman priest at Thankful Memorial Episcopal, which is right down from St. Mary's. It's this big, beautiful, beautiful church. But they have low attendance. And then you've got Marty's church, which is, you know, they're having to be supported by the diocese.
Has regular attendance, but not much money.
Right. They're like, what if we combine these churches? Mm-hmm. They go to the diocese and they're like, you know, let's merge these two together. And the diocese is like, yep, you know what? This actually fixes our problem because we are having to support St. Mary's anyway. But the thing is, the name of Thankful could not be changed. The land was donated by a man named Colonel A.M. Johnson, And he helped build up the St. Elmo area by selling off his family farm. And at his death, he gave the land to the church, and he said that it had to be named after Thankful, his wife, but the name could never be changed. What do we do with the legacy of St. Mary's? They sold the building that St. Mary's was in for $65,000, and the church wanted the money. Like, the diocese wanted the money because they had been supporting them. But Marty's like, they should probably get the money. We've already merged their church. You know, they're losing a little bit of their identity. Let's leave the money here. The other problem is, who's going to be in charge? They moved to Chris's established building, and there's only one rector in the church. The first merged services were held on March 1st, which was Ash Wednesday, but it wasn't actually finalized till that December. Marty and Chris have this awesome, new, beautiful church together, and they're making it work. So at this time, Chris is dating a man named Jim. I'm not completely sure what Marty's relationship was with Jim, but Chris is in this new relationship. By 1996, Marty is realizing he needs to date. He needs to get out. He needs to meet people. So he goes on a few dates with a man named Jacob Richards. Jacob was only 21 at the time, and he attended the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. He was employed at the Big River Grill and the Sports Barn in Chattanooga. At the beginning of April 1996, Jacob jumps off of the Old Johnny Bridge. He survives for a few days in the hospital before passing away, but ended up dying on April 15th. This landed the same week as Holy Week, which is a very big deal for the Episcopal Church. And Marty just blows it off. At this point, he's not doing good. He would not change his clothes from the clothes he was wearing the night that he found out that Jacob had, you know, attempted this. And he told his friend, "I can't change my clothes. I'm scared, you know, Jacob will pass if I do." It's not good on him to miss Holy Week. And at this point, he's not in a great place. That September, he's pulled over for a DUI. When the police officer pulls him over, he literally just gets out of the car and says, "I cannot tell a lie. I'm drunk. You caught me. I'm drunk."
In Marty form.
So they take him to jail, and Chris comes to bail him out. He was sentenced to serve weekends at Silverdale, and Michael's dad is the one that was driving him to serve these. And that October, Chris and Jim get married, and Chris gets pregnant. So by February of 97, Chris goes to Bishop Tharp, who is the main guy over the area.
He's the district manager, if you will.
Yes, the Episcopal churches. And she's saying, you know, "Listen, something's going on with Marty, and I feel like Marty probably needs help." So the diocese sent him to a treatment center in Minnesota called Hazleton Betty Ford. And this is a rehab that is for, like, alcohol issues, stuff like that. But he gets there and he's like, "Listen, alcohol isn't my issue. I'm depressed.
Right.
I need help for my depression, not alcoholism."
Right.
So they send him to this place in Maryland. And I've heard that this ends up being where they send, like, priests with sexual issues. I cannot confirm that 100% to be true, because obviously I can't just openly find that. And Marty's there and he's still like, this is not
working
like,
for me. He's like, "That's not it either."
But okay. So April 25th, while he's there, he hears word that releasing him from his position at church. So he immediately flies home, not to mention Michael had just moved out.
So you have no roommate.
Right.
You have no job.
Right.
You have, and you're stuck halfway across the country.
Exactly.
So, yeah, that's not good.
Yeah. What are you supposed to do? Father Carter had always been a role model to Marty, even like when he was in seminary. And he was actually the one that put Marty on the plane to rehab and was like, you know, "Get this worked out, get back here and we'll move on with life."
Keep on driving.
Right. So he hired Marty at St. Peter's and he was like collecting crutches, answering phones, using the computer to find a job, just miscellaneous thing. And it's actually funny because the secretary of St. Peter's at the time, when I talked to her, she said that, like, Marty was supposed to be collecting all these medical supplies and came in literally, like, a Ralph Lauren blazer.
And he had actually told that that same secretary that he was online dating at the time, but didn't really go into detail. So he was trying to pick his life up. He was trying to, you know, get back on the right track because he was also supposed to be director of Camp Billy Johnson that year, which was going to start July 20th. And he was about to actually meet with Bob about his next assignment. His sister, Mitzi, says that a few weeks before his death, Marty had told them that a brick was thrown through his window and someone had yelled out a gay slur as they drove past his house. Iva Dean was actually about to go to Myrtle Beach at the time. And they were concerned about, like, Marty's safety. So they thought about not going, but he was like, I'm fine. Go on. Enjoy your summer vacation. When I talk to people about this brick, Michael does not have any.
He hadn't heard of it.
Mitzi, his sister, has.
Yes.
We have a clip that I am going to put in right here of an old Cold Justice episode from, I think, 2008 or 2009. Mm-hmm. And their brother, Tommy, is talking about said brick.
Okay.
And then Chris mentions the brick when I speak to her.
Okay.
I don't know the story on the brick. But if Iva Dean and Mitzi were worried, literally this has happened, they're worried to go on vacation because of Marty. I'm so confused at what this means.
Just strange.
Yeah. I don't know where it is. But since Tommy mentions it, I feel like I need to mention it.
Because just a it's weird. Something.
Right.
Something. We don't know if it means anything.
Something enough was going on that his mom was worried to leave town.
Right.
July 4th weekend. Marty goes down to Alabama and he's talking to his friend Darlene. And he's like, you know, I'm feeling really weird about this whole church situation. Now my members have been uprooted from their church. They don't even have me anymore. And I really feel like I want to talk to the diocese about everything that's went down and tell them what I feel about it. And Darlene said, okay, well, you know, is this for you? Is this closure for you or is this for the church? So something was bothering Marty at that time.
Yeah.
We don't know if it was this brick. We don't know if the brick had happened. We don't know what was going on.
Yeah. And it could be so many things.
Yeah.
It could be just, you know, wanting to just to talk to somebody, you know.
Right. Carter was actually going out of town for a church thing. And he asked Marty to fill in for him for the general convention that was in town. So Marty covered the first Sunday. And then that Wednesday, he didn't show up. Around 8 o'clock in the morning on July 16th, 1997, his across the street neighbor was going out into his yard to do his morning routine. Probably, you know, he had a little dog, let his dog out, mm-hmm. grabbed the newspaper, all that. And as he's outside doing his little morning routine, he witnesses a black man walk just straight into Marty's house. Does not knock, just walks straight in. The neighbor walks back up his driveway, which isn't very long. It's a pretty short driveway. Back in the driveway, walks into the house, checks all the blinds, and he sees this guy running from Marty's house.
This is in the span of like a minute.
Yeah, I'd say probably no more than 5 minutes.
Yeah.
It was not a long...
Yeah.
The man was reportedly wearing black jeans and a shirt with gray and burgundy stripes. He was about 5'10 to 6 feet tall and like 180, 190 in his late 20s to early 30s. This neighbor mentions to a friend of Marty's that he saw the man run from the house with a manila envelope. That is not released in any of the newspaper clippings. That is not been confirmed to me by the police department.
It's not in the report.
But that has also not been denied to me by the police department.
Yeah.
We do not know the validity of the manila envelope, but it has been mentioned. So the neighbor next to the across the street neighbor is the one that took care of Marty's house when he was out of town.
Yeah.
So neighbor number one calls neighbor number two. And he's like, hey, is Marty in town? Yeah, he is. We need to go check on him. It seems like somebody just like ran up out of his house.
That's weird.
Right. So they walk across the street. They look into Marty's house. It looks like from the front porch, the door that is there now is still the door that was there. And it has glass in it. But it also looks like you can look into the window from the porch. So
yeah,
somewhere as they walked up to the front porch, up to the house.
They can see into the house.
Yes. They could see Marty laying on the floor in his boxer shorts and a shirt. The way the house is laid out is when you open the front door, the living room goes into the dining room. On one side, there's a door off to the kitchen, and on another side, there's a door off, like a doorway off to the hallway, which is the bedrooms and the bathroom off of it. They could see Marty laying between the dining living room area and the floor, surrounded by blood.
It is a very, very messy, very bloody scene. They are going to know as soon as they see it, something is wrong.
Yes. I mean, there was no question about it. It was the 21st homicide in 1997 in the third and 5 days in Chattanooga.
Absolutely swamped. If you guys remember when we talked about Victor Showers, it was the same thing there. Like, they're just overrun.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it was crazy in Chattanooga at the time. And there, at the time, there wasn't a police chief at some point for like a year. So things were just chaotic in Chattanooga at the time. Marty had been shot 7 times. We're going to describe these to you because we want you to understand how horrible this was.
This was brutal. Prepare yourselves.
We believe the way that they are listed are the way that they happened, and that's why they are listed the way they are. In the autopsy. Yeah. We have gunshot A, which is the entry of his left shoulder, and that is essentially front to back, left to right, downward.
And there is a lot of stippling, and there's residue, and there's powder there. So these were very, very close shots.
Yes.
And he has bruises everywhere. He was fighting.
Absolutely. He has a grazed wound on his chin labeled as B, and that is also directed downward.
It's a shot that goes down, and they're not sure if it just grazed or if it actually continued.
So then we have C, which is into his neck, which was also downward, and it passed through the neck into the right chest cavity where the bullet was recovered. We have D, which is entry into the left temple, which is also downward. And we also have a lot of stippling, which indicates a very close range. Then we have E, which is the left side of his head.
Which, let's be honest, any of these shots, besides the arm one, could have ended Marty's life.
Yeah.
Why they kept going, we don't know.
Especially everything after D.
Yeah.
We have F, which is also head entry. But this one was upward. Then we have H, entry lower back, and it is downward, stopping in the abdominal wall. Which means chances are, for this one, Marty was laying on the ground. Like Randa said, he had multiple abrasions, contusions, bruises, and it actually even says in his autopsy report that it was in a pattern of injury consistent with physical struggle prior to death. His alcohol blood kit was negative, and so was his drug test and sexual assault kit.
The only thing that was in there was an antidepressant.
Yes. So all those.
And it was like normal.
Well, like, uterine.
Regulated dose.
Yes. At the time of his death, he had no food particles or pills in his stomach, but he did have a brown, tan, semi-solid material, which could be anything, but no actual food. So chances are he hadn't even had time to have like breakfast yet.
Yeah.
Which he notoriously loves cereal for breakfast. Nail clippings were sent off for testing, but we don't have
those results.
A copy of those. His left elbow was all skinned up and he had like bruises right under his left armpit on the back of his arm. his left shin was all skinned up or, you know, marked up. We can't tell what kind of skinned up, but bruised. His right wrist had bruising and a mark on the back of his right arm, right next to his armpit. He had two marks on his right thigh and one large mark on his right shin. Once again, I'm saying mark because we don't know if it was a bruise, if it was a scrape. We can only see
what's diagram. Indicated on the report.
And like we said, that's all we know. That's all we know on the scene. Since this is an open case, that's all we know.
As far as physical evidence, that's what we have.
We do know both his glasses and his wallet were missing from the scene. But that's the only thing we know about the actual scene, the case. His sister, Mitzi, is the one that cleaned it up, that cleaned the house up.
God bless her heart. I mean, Lord Jesus.
I know.
Oh.
And so that's how we know this, what it looked like.
Mm-hmm.
One of his credit cards was found and reported to the credit card company the same day he died. And the company put a block on it. During the investigation, the detectives discovered the block. The credit card company were just like, we don't know who this is. This woman found this card. We told her to dispose of it, which unfortunately she did. They find her. All she says, she found the card off of what we suspect was probably Youngstown Road. Nothing ever comes of it. The card's gone. July 17th, a 17-year-old boy's home in St. Elmo was searched. A foreign fingerprint was found on a VHS tape sleeve, but that actually led back to a video rental employee. So that was nothing.
Explanations for why it's there.
Yeah. And other than that, people had to move on. Chris and Jim ended up getting a divorce. Chris went up to New York. We think that Jim probably went to Virginia from 1999 till his death in 2008. He had like 45 arrests at that point, and most of them were drunk in public. But that's the only information that we can find about him. Jolie and Mimi went on with their lives. Camp Billy Johnson still went on that year. They decided that's what Marty would have wanted. And over time, this case was just shelved. It was actually early on a Wednesday morning, and he was caught before he had time to even get dressed. Made no sense to anyone, but rumors went around.
Yeah, like nothing. It's not like Marty had enemy.
Right.
You know, it's not like he had somebody like out to get him for no reason.
Some of the rumors that I've actually heard from people is that it was someone dressed as a delivery driver. It was a gang initiation killing. That he had secretly been meeting men by the Chickamauga Dam and it was a scorned lover.
We disproved that one.
We disproved that one. I think that somebody fed that information to the police. I think that was just an easy rumor to start about a gay man in the night.
Exactly.
And actually, what brought this case to the surface years later was there was a judge, and his secretary was going through some of the tapes in his safe that he would normally transcribe. And some of these tapes, the judge himself was recording torturous, essentially perverted murder fantasies. And there is no evidence that this has anything to do with Marty, but this judge knew Marty and they had previously attended church together. So that was even brought back up. And when you search this case, honestly, you find a lot of information on that judge. He is still living.
Ain't it funny?
We're not going to say anything else about that, but
y'all can Google.
Y'all can find that. And that got Marty's name back in the news for a little bit, but even then, nothing came of it. When his siblings went through his canceled checks, even in the days that he didn't know how he was going to pay his mortgage, he was still giving money to charities and homeless, still helping people when he couldn't even help himself at that point. This really seemed easy to solve even in 1997, but here we are, and I desperately wish that I could say that that was the last time that Marty Davis was failed, but unfortunately it was
not. It wasn't.
A Because years later, the GBI contacted Marty's family to let them know that he was probably one of the bodies at the Marsh Crematorium scandal.
Y'all go back and listen to that episode if you need a refresher.
Yes. Unfortunately, that's all we know. I wish we could say more. I wish we could tell you all of our theories, but we can't. I desperately hope one day this case is solved. At this point, I don't think that's going to happen.
So unfortunate, because Marty deserved so much more than what he got.
Helped so many others, but was forgotten.
Cast aside, really.
Yeah. And so I think even if it's two girls that never met the man a day in his life, if we're the only two that can keep people talking about Marty Davis.
I'll dig up the dirt, sister.
Yeah. We have a TikTok that I've not posted on in forever. We have an Instagram. We have a Facebook group. We have a Reddit. And I have justiceformartydavis.com. Feel free to reach out to us on the podcast stuff, on any of the Marty Davis stuff. If you want to talk about it, we'll talk about this case with you all day long.
And again, we don't have a detective assigned. So if you guys want to try to run through theories with us or whatever, we'd be more than happy to discuss. Or if you or a family member were a member at Marty's church or attended and have some fun little stories about him, we'd love to hear them.
We would love that.
It's a stumper. Yeah. It is a stumper.
Yeah, we'll just end it there. I know this doesn't feel resolved. I know this doesn't really feel like we even told you much, but that's all we got.
You guys know what we know.
And we're going to continue to work on this. I don't know really what else we can do, but we're going to keep pushing forward.
The recent fight over an audio tape made by a Bradley County judge has renewed interest in a 10-year-old murder case. Now, Chattanooga police say that audio tape made by former Judge John Hagler won't help them find the killer of a local priest, but they're hoping that you might have the clue to solve this cold case. It's a story you'll see only on 12. It's July 16, 1997. A neighbor of Marty Davis sees a young black man in his teens or early 20s walk into his house, then come back out a few minutes later. That neighbor then gets another neighbor to investigate.
They go around to the side, look in windows, and they see Marty's body lying on the floor in the living room.
Episcopalian priest Marty Davis was shot multiple times with a small caliber weapon, leading to another murder investigation in Chattanooga. The Marty Davis investigation has proved to be a tough case to crack. Over the last 10 years, detectives have interviewed more than 35 potential suspects. They keep coming back to this composite sketch of the man neighbors saw going into Davis's home. But who is this young man, and why would he kill a local priest? Here's what we do know about the murder investigation. As a priest, Marty Davis was very involved in helping those in need, whether it meant going into a bad neighborhood to deliver food or helping the homeless.
A suspect could have come out of any of these little, you know, any of these. He was...
Marty's brother, Tommy Davis, says before his brother died, he was living in fear.
He had been threatened by someone throwing a rock through his window with a note attached to it. He was getting drive-by threats when he was going in certain neighborhoods to delivering food to elderly people. He was receiving threats.
Which brings us back to the young man who police believe pulled the trigger. Was it someone that Marty Davis had helped? Other neighbors later confirmed they saw this suspect in the neighborhood earlier on the day Marty died. After all these years, though, investigators still can't identify their prime suspect.
It's just really, really strange that he'd walk in the middle of the day, do what he did, walk out, be seen as much as he did, and just vanish.
That's why the family and Chattanooga investigators hope you can help them solve this case. After more than a decade, Tommy Davis says that would bring some closure.
I want to know why. Why, Marty, if you knew him, Marty was a nice guy. He just wasn't a person that would precipitate or bring on that type of brutality. I'd like to know who. I'd like to know why. I may not ever know on this earth.
If you know what happened to Marty Davis, or if you think you know who killed him, please call Chattanooga Police.
Hey guys, it's Ashley. While I was sitting here editing, I really want to come on here and just from the bottom of my heart, thank Marty's friends and family who have helped us. I have had to call so many strangers and ask you to talk to me about the hardest times in your life. And I cannot imagine having to recount some of those moments with a complete stranger. But you have also told me the absolute sweetest memories about Marty. And I want you to know that even though this case is not currently being investigated, I will never stop working to get some type of justice for Marty Davis. I never got the pleasure of knowing him, but he sounds absolutely amazing. And I want him to have the recognition that he deserves for everything he did in life. And so I just from the bottom of my heart want to thank you all so much for helping us be able to get this together so that we can tell everyone about Marty and what happened to him and get people talking about how crazy this is that it's still sitting on his shelves 27 years later. So thank you so much for listening. Thank you to everyone who's reached out. Thank you to everyone who's talked to us. And please continue to spread the name Marty Davis.